Good afternoon. So before the break, we had switched away from talking about security over networks. You know, the topic we got into after talking a bit about networking, and then having started the semester looking at kind of how OSs and hardware cooperate in terms of exceptions and page tables. And you know, so we had that foray into networking. Now we're back to talking about kind of low-level stuff about how the processor does stuff to make programs faster. And first one we're talking about is this idea of caching. So we're going to talk about having these small stores, these caches, that somehow really speed up our programs, because these small stores can be much faster than our big memory. But the problem there is that, well, they're only fast if we're accessing a small amount of stuff. And surely that's not what a program that uses many megabytes of memory is doing. But it turns out that it kind of is. And then we have this principles of locality that made this possible. That typically when our program accesses something, it accesses something nearby soon. We call that spatial locality. And typically when it accesses something, it accesses that same thing again soon. We call that temporal locality. So we have these two types of locality. Spatial, for we access something and then something nearby, and temporal, for we access something and we access it again later, probably relatively soon. And we just mentioned that these are just things which happen. We don't have to write our programs to have extra locality most of the time. Usually they'll just have a good amount of locality. And we also mentioned that, well, when you learned about assembly, that we have these registers. And these registers are kind of the compiler taking advantage of locality by, instead of putting things in memory, which turns out to be caches, putting it in registers. And kind of the caches are the hardware's way of doing this, even when our program hasn't been written by the compiler to do it fully. And we talked about kind of our most basic cache design, at least one of the most basic ones, which is direct map caches. And in this design, we wanted our cache to not be able to cache just one thing, but cache lots of things. So we had a bunch of blocks in our cache, and each block would be correspond to a block of memory. And kind of like when we did paging, we divided up our cache into these fixed size blocks and our actual main memory into these fixed size blocks. Kind of how with paging, we divided up our sort of virtual and physical addresses into the same size blocks. We had the same kind of idea for our cache and our actual memory. But we have this rule with direct map caches, hence the name direct mapped, that we have this many-to-one relationship, that each block of cache corresponds to a set of blocks of memory, but in each block of memory corresponds to exactly one block of cache. And to figure out what block of cache a block of memory corresponded to, we chose to have our cache have a power of two number of blocks. And this meant the way the division worked, we could just look at some of the bits of the address and figure out which row it goes to, which we call sets, and we'll see why we call them sets today. So our cache lookup, with this in mind, we end up dividing up our address into three parts. We have our tag, our index, and our offset. And the index is which row of the cache do we go to. So if we have 2 to the S rows, we need S bits for that index, because we want to have a unique index for each row and not any leftover. Then we're going to get a block from the cache. But we need to know, well, there's this many-to-one relationship for how memory maps to that block. We need to know, is it the right one? So we have this tag to let us know that. And the tag is just those upper bits of the address that we don't otherwise use in this lookup. Then once we know we have the right block, we need to actually get the right part of that block, because typically our blocks are going to store many bytes, and we're going to be fetching one or a small number of bytes. So we use the offset to figure that out. The offset tells us where in the block we are, and it's the lower bits of our address. So having known how direct map caches work, we started looking into sort of how these actually worked with programs more directly, because we started just abstractly saying, we look up these addresses, and think about, well, how does that work with our programs? We mentioned that one sort of high-level thing you'll notice if you look at a typical processor is we have separate caches for instructions and data, because there's two big types of memory accesses our programs do. We access instructions to get the machine code, We access the data that your instructions like move something from memory with. And then we started looking at, well, how does this actually correspond to C code to get sort of a better intuition for like what is the direct map cache design mean? And one thing we discovered last time, which we'll review in a bit, was about alignment. That it turns out we probably want things to start at the beginning of cache blocks, because it's really bad if we have to split one value across two cache blocks, because that means instead of accessing one thing from memory, we're going to have to access two things from memory, because when we access the cache only loads a block at a time. Cache isn't going to be able to take advantage of the fact that we only want half of that block or a quarter of that block. It's going to get the whole block and cache it. And if some of that block is irrelevant to us, well, still going to cache it. So we learned that one thing that would be nice for compilers to do is try to have things, you know, take up as much of the cache block as possible and not be split across cache blocks when they don't need to be. So that's where we left off last time. So questions about things we covered before, just before the break? Okay, not seeing any. And okay. So had some anonymous feedback saying the quiz, not liking the quiz, with one specific comment, which I will get to in a bit. So let's go over the quiz, because looking at the results, apparently I thought I taught TLS much better than actually happened. So we should talk about question one. So question one had two options that people really liked selecting that were not true. So one of them was that the certificate contains a public encryption key that the web browser uses to encrypt. And there's two problems with it, to encrypt the path. And the path, what's the path? So the path was one of the parts of a URL. So if we have https foo.com/bar, this slash bar is the path. So that's something we send to the web server after we connect to it. And in TLS, the way things work is we had this handshake process, which was all set up, and only then do we actually start communicating with the web server for real. And when we're actually communicating with the web server for real, we set up a sort of temporary set of symmetric encryption keys. And there's a couple reasons we use symmetric encryption keys. So one was that it's a lot faster. The asymmetric encryption and signatures are pretty slow. Symmetric encryption and message authentication codes are pretty fast. Another reason is that we wanted this property of forward secrecy that if we compromise the server a month later, that we can't take a recording of the network traffic and read it from that. And having separate keys for each connection lets us do that because the separate keys will be discarded after, you know, hopefully after like an hour, but at least hopefully after a month. The other reason is that if you looked at our example of sort of the most common way the handshake worked, we used the key in the certificate as a signing key. Because we did this key exchange process and the server verified that it was the getting the correct information from the correct server by signing something rather than by encrypting anything. The other option people really like selecting that isn't quite true is that the certificate is verified primarily by the web browser contacting the certificate authority. So kind of the point of the certificate is that it contains a signature. And that signature is everything we need to know that yes, the certificate authority really vetted this. And that's kind of the big advantage of certificates is that we don't have to contact the certificate authority individually each time. We just look at the certificate and it's kind of as long as we know the public key of the server, the certificate authority, it sort of verifies with just the certificate and that public key. We don't need anything else. And this is really good for scalability because it would be really annoying, you know, if you made a certificate for google.com and every time someone tried to contact google.com, now you have to deal with that too. Like that would make writing the certificate authority not very viable. Now, if you're being nitpicky, you might say, wait a moment, isn't there this revocation checking thing? And yes, there is, and we didn't talk about it in detail. It is true that sometimes browsers might contact the CA to check revocation information. That is less common than you would think, and often done indirectly. Often it will be done in a way where, like, the browsers will get the information from the CA and send it to the browser makers and send it to the browsers via, like, a software update. So questions on quiz question one? Nope, we're all okay. I was expecting more because, yeah.
I have a question about the part B. It says that the web browser checks for the DNS name of the web server they're connecting to, but if they're connecting to it, wouldn't they already know the DNS browser?
So the question is in question one, part B, I said that the web browser compares the DNS name it connected to the information in the certificate. And the question is, doesn't the web browser already know who it's connecting to? The web browser knows who it intended to connect to. But the part of the point of having the certificate is that if, say, we're on a network which we don't really trust, we have this second verification that the name of the server we're connecting to really is the one we intended to connect to and not something where the network is fooling us. Does that answer your question? So the question is, how does this relate to the certificate verify message? So in our TLS handshake, the basic idea is that each side sends a key share, and then we send the certificate and the certificate verify message. And the certificate verify message, what it is verifying, it's verifying that the key share the server sent comes from the same server that that certificate belongs to. It's not verifying anything else about that, about the server. It's a signature over the key share using the key that's in the certificate. Does that answer your question? So it's not, the server can't attest to having the right domain name. The certificate authority does that in a certificate, but the server itself we don't trust it to do that. Because if we did, then any Wi-Fi hotspot could spin up a server that says, yes, I'm really google.com, and we don't trust them to do that. Is that clear? Okay, other questions? Okay, so then we have question two. In this design, we had A and B set up some symmetric keys by using key agreement. And we mentioned the idea of key agreement is that you get some secret information for each party and you produce a key share from that. And you can combine the other person's key share and your secret information to get a common secret value that the other person will do the similar computation and get the same thing. And was asking what things could a network attacker do to this? And a lot of people wanted to say that someone who is looking at the key share sent by A and B could compute that same secret information that A and B were computing. And that's not how key agreement works. Because when we compute the secret, we're going to need to combine one person's secret with another person's key share. The value we're going to compute is going to depend on both of those. So if we have our own third one, so if we have the attacker key share and S, we'll have the attacker M key share, then the attacker, yes, can compute a secret value, but the value they're going to compute is going to be using SM and, say, A's key share. That's going to be different than the one used that A would compute using B's key share. Because we aren't matching it up correctly. We aren't matching it up in the same way that A is. Is that questions on this? Yeah.
For option B on this, so it made, like, the way it was written, it seemed like they were using symmetric encryption anyway, and if they weren't able to share the keys in the first place, then they won't have the keys for symmetric encryption and won't be able to communicate at all. Like, that's how I read that.
For option B, what was option B? I don't have pulled up quickly. Where did I put my browser? What was option B? Sorry.
Make A and B be unable to exchange D shares despite being able to sell each
other. OK, so the question, option B was asking if someone with control over the network could prevent A and B from doing this, but still let them exchange messages. And a simple way of doing that is we could let them send messages that look like normal text and not other messages. And because these messages are very hard to make look like normal text, that would probably achieve that goal. So that, and that's kind of this kind of idea what I was going for.
Yeah, but what I was saying is like if they weren't able to exchange like the key shares in the first step, then how would they communicate with using symmetric encryption because they can't generate the key for symmetric encryption?
The question, if they weren't able to share keys in the first step, how would they communicate with symmetric encryption? I believe the question said insecure. So they would communicate insecurely. So without encryption in a way where other people could intercept the message. Does that answer your question? Yes.
So if they're communicating insecurely, how do you differentiate like the key share from any other message? Since it's not encrypted, what if you send like numbers over that message? How are you like separating that?
So the question is, how would an attacker know that it's a key share and not something else? And yes, maybe this is something where I thought this was an easy problem and it isn't really. So I guess if we know the protocol in advance, we probably know what marks a key share and what doesn't. If we don't, yes, maybe the attacker would have to guess and do something unreliable. So when people do this in practice, so if you look at, for example, Tor, which tries to do censorship-resistant communication, usually what you have to end up doing is you have to end up making your key share exchange look like random noise. But then the problem is that you're sending a bunch of random noise. And like that probably is kind of apparent to someone listening. And you can try to, but probably there are things you could do to make it look like something more normal. And maybe I should discount the option for that reason. Because that, yes, that is something you could do. It's a lot of work though, right? If you're just doing the straightforward thing, like if you're doing TLS, it's gonna be very obvious this is sending a key share for TLS because TLS is designed to be easy to implement and have everything marked nicely and all that. That answer your question? Yes.
So when I was taking the quiz, I was kind of like Tuesday's lecture, like last week, and like when you're talking about TLS Kentik, you like specifically said like someone asked a question that you said some malicious party like you cannot replace key share messages with their own because it won't make a valid certificate verifier message.
Yes.
So like I don't know the scenario like.
So the question is, how does the TLS scenario compare to this?
Yeah.
And in lecture, I said we can use a certificate verify message. So the protocol here doesn't have one.
Yeah.
So there's nothing stopping someone from replacing the key share message with something else, because there's no way that if you're B, for example, there's no way you can tell that it actually comes from A, because you don't have any sort of like signature or anything like that to let you distinguish that it's from A or someone who's like an attacker like we were in the lab.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I
re-explain the definition of a key share? Sure. So key agreement is something that's kind of like a very limited purpose encryption, where rather than encrypting a message, we just get a common value that we can use for making keys. And in key agreement, our key share is kind of like our public key, and we have this secret, which is kind of like our private key. And the idea is we can combine anyone else's public key with our private key to get a number, and they can combine their private key with our public key to get the same number. And we use that number as a key. Does that help? Yeah.
For responses to B, it says that replacing A's key share will allow them to take this decision. Why wouldn't it be that it allowed them to take
this decision? Sorry?
Why does replacing A's key share allow the attacker to take B's place and not A's?
Why does replacing A's key share allow the attacker to take A's place and not B's place? That might be an error in the question, which where is my browser window? Okay, apparently I just do not have, oh, there is my browser window, okay. So let me actually read the key and see if that's really what I did. So the key, and of course, when I want to do login, it has to time. Do that, and we go here. So we're saying, yes, that is an oversight. That is an oversight in the question. I will need to think about what to do about that. Which somehow no one reading the quiz early noticed. Like, it's feasible to also replace A's, but yeah, that's,
For question B, like, if you did all of those things,
if I did all what things?
If you
replace
both B and
C, so I guess D is fine. D is fine, but we're describing the order of things incorrectly. You replace A's key short to take the place of A, and B's key short to take the place of B. But yes, if you do all those things, you are in the middle of the conversation for both parties. Is that what you were saying? Sorry? Yeah, so this should be A, and this should be A for B and B for A. It just should be swapped. I probably need to drop that question. Yeah.
Can I just go back to the third answer key?
Yeah.
It says 26%. Does that mean 26% of students correctly did not check the box? Or
the question is, what does the 26% mean? That is 26% checked that box. Questions. What would happen if that question is dropped? I will count all answers for C and D as correct, no matter what was actually selected. Yes.
Oh, I have a question about ports. Is the TLS handshake on the secure TLS port, like port A, if I'm remembering correctly, or is it also like the unencrypted
So the question is, how does TLS relate to port numbers? So TLS runs across TCP, and conventionally, for HTTP over TLS uses port 443 for everything. Does that answer your question?
Okay, yeah, so I was just wondering, if it's like the, problem was number three, when they say that the attacker could block C shares, but
So the question is, if we're talking about the attacker blocking encrypted traffic and not unencrypted traffic, if we're following the conventional port numbers, yes, that's very trivial because all the encrypted traffic's on one port number, all the unencrypted's on another one. If we actually follow that, but we don't have to. Other questions, comments? Okay, so let's get to question 4 and question 5. So there was anonymous feedback, and I think some other confusion on this question, for the hash table complaining, wait a moment, you didn't tell us how conflicts are resolved, and how collisions are resolved, and I was aware of that because I thought that it didn't change the answers. So if we're thinking about these two methods of deduplication using a hash table, so this was question 4 was asking, if we're using a hash table to deduplicate something, so we go through an array, look up everything in a hash table, adding if it's not there, and if it is there, not adding it to our output. The hash table would have really bad spatial locality, because hopefully, when we get a key, we're basically choosing a random bucket in the hash. And like that's kind of evenly spread out among all the buckets. So the spatial locality should be basically as if we're doing random accesses to the hash table. So it's basically as bad as it could be. Or not as bad as it could be, but very close to as bad as it could be. But the temporal locality, if we have lots of duplicates, we should have a good temporal locality because we'll access the exact same bucket every time there's a duplicate as something we accessed recently, assuming we have lots of, the same thing. Yes?
Is there a way to I'm trying to remember. I think we learned about a hash table. It's like essentially like an array that you block out where it's continuously stored, but you like hash a key to get like the index in that array. So if the hash table's elements are like all together because it's an array, they're stored continuously in memory. When you have spatial locality, because you're not jumping through like pointers like in a linked list, like you're accessing like the same place kind of in memory, just showing different indices.
So the question is, because we should be using our hash table sort of buckets at a high rate, shouldn't we have spatial locality from that? I agree, but it's still pretty weak because they should be, because let's say our hash table has 1,000 entries, right? We're choosing a random place in those 1,000. So the rule that if I see you us accessing bucket 502, I'm gonna access 503, 504, 505, or 506 soon, that's not such a great bet. Yeah. Sorry, why would?
Accesses to the input array be included. I assume it's just like once you got the number from the input array, everything you do.
Okay, question is why were there accesses to the input array when we're looking up things in the hash table? My assumption was we had to read the value from the array to figure out what to look up in the hash table and do the comparison.
Okay, I assumed that meant.
I guess that explains why that people felt that was unclear. That is something I felt was kind of, I was just thinking of, oh, we have this code that uses an array and a hash table, how would it look? That's how I was thinking about it. Yeah. Yeah, I was not thinking so refined. Right. I'm sorry for not being clear. Yes. Can I explain the difference between the hash table and the input array? So the input array is the list of values you want to deduplicate. The hash table is this temporary data structure we were using to figure out whether there are duplicates, and more efficiently than scanning the array, because the array is not sorted or ordered in any particular way. So if we wanted to scan for something in the input array, we'd have to go through every element. But with a hash table, we can look up the appropriate bucket, and we know that's where we'll find it if it's there. Or we'll find it there, or if there's a collision, we'll have to do some resolution for collisions like chaining or something like that. So the question, does the hash table store the input array? That was the algorithm we were using, yes. We put the input array in the hash table, and because a hash table detects duplicates, we would get rid of duplicates that way. Yes?
When we're talking about temporal locality for the input array, is it only talking about, is it talking about also temporal locality in regards to instructions? I kind of read that as there's some set of instructions that we use.
The question is, was I talking about temporal locality with regard to the instructions? The instructions aren't in the array. I agree there is a lot of good temporal locality in the instructions, but that's not part of the array.
So it's only talking about
the actual data. Yes. Oh, so the question is, how does this algorithm work given that hash tables I learned about store key value pairs? So in this case, we only care about the key. So if we didn't have a hash table that supported only having keys, we'd have our key and our value would be like an empty string for everything or something like that. Right, wouldn't matter. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so question 5 asks, if we made the hash function better, how would that affect locality? And it would not improve spatial locality, because if we had this case where two values happen to clump in our table, that would happen less with a better hash function. They'd be more spread out. And if we had temporal locality from like doing a linked list traversals to deal with collisions or doing probing to deal with collisions, that would happen less with a better hash function. So that would also, there'd be less of that, but we would have fewer cache accesses because we're doing less collision resolution. So it would still be faster, but not in terms of locality. Yes, that's it. Question, when thinking about spatial and temporal locality, do I consider loading code from memory? Yes. I would say that's the locality of the code itself, but it is definitely a thing we have to worry about. Usually I don't talk about it much because it's not something that you usually have to do anything to make good. But it is something that, yeah, sometimes people have to do something with. Yes. Could I interpret choice B as improve temporal localities, reduce collisions? I would call that, so as far as the cache is concerned, this is not better. Because with collisions, the cache is having lots of times where it's accessing something that you've accessed again because it's of a collision, which is not happening anymore. So I agree, the reduced collisions is better, but it's not better for the cache. As far as the cache is looking at this, oh, I'm getting a lot fewer times where my cache is useful. And the locality, the temporal locality is not, in fact, better. Even though, yes, the performance is better, and that's just because we're using memory less overall. Does that answer your question?
What? Would a better hash function...
Would a better hash function improve the temporal locality? So there's two sources of our temporal locality. So one is from we're actually accessing the same thing in the hash over and over again. That's not going to change when we change our hash function. It's going to be the same. There's another, which is kind of this false economy temporal locality, where when we're resolving collisions, we're going through the same elements for different keys. Like, that's something where we'll have temporal locality because of that, but it's not actually something we want, because we can just get rid of those accesses to speed things up instead. That answer your question? Yeah.
You said that it improves the spatial locality. I interpret it as lessening the spread of that. So if I interpret it that way, would I be correct?
So the question is, you said because when I said it improves spatial locality, you interpret it as lessening the spread. That is not what a better hash function does. A better hash function will more evenly distribute the data across the hash table. Yes?
It still feels kind of unclear what a better hash function means in that scenario. Because I interpret it as like you would have less collisions, but it would also be closer to like a regular array where values that are similar to each other are stored close together.
So okay, so
I interpreted that as more spatial locality, even though it would still be better because there would be less, because you would make it so it doesn't collide as much, but the values that are similar would be more close together, so you would have spatial locality.
Okay, so you're saying, couldn't we make a hash function with less collisions that makes the values less spread out? I agree that's true. This is not our typical strategy for making a better hash function. Like, typically when we model a hash function, we want it to be as random functions. Or we have something very specifically constructed for our keys. But I agree, if we had one specifically constructed for our keys, maybe we could do that. That was not something I was thinking about. I was thinking, if we have a general purpose hash function, having close values be nearby is actually probably not useful for a hash table, because it's hard to think of how to do that efficiently and avoid collisions. But if we have if we know the set of keys, yeah, we could make a hash function that doesn't spread the values out and avoids collisions. And I agree with that. This is not something I was thinking about because those aren't general purpose hash functions. If we're making a general purpose hash function, you want to spread it out more. Spread it out more randomly. When more random is better when we don't know the keys in advance, because we can't really plan to clump things up together and also avoid collisions. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I guess I need to think about adjusting the quiz on the key a bunch, because I wasn't thinking of hashes in the same way and other things. Okay. So last time, when we finished up, we were looking at this sort of simple scenario, I have a four element array, and we're accessing it index 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. And the question is, if I have a very, very simple cache, I have one block in my cache, how is this going to work? And one thing we need to figure out is how do our blocks of memory correspond to our blocks in the cache? And kind of our ideal case is something like this, that the array starts at the beginning of a cache block, so when you read 0, we bring in 0 and 1, you have a miss, then a hit, then a miss, when we read in 2, it brings in 2 and 3, and a hit. A bad case, well, less good, but still okay, is that maybe, especially with larger cache blocks, the array is not going to start at the beginning of one. And this is actually a common thing in practice, because typically our cache block size isn't like 8 bytes, it's like 64 bytes. And if our compiler made every array start at the beginning of a cache block, well, we have to like waste 32 bytes lots of times. You probably wouldn't be happy with that. So you might end up with a case like this. We could also have a case like this, where in order to read an array of 0, we actually need to access the cache twice. That's really annoying, and compilers will usually make the effort to prevent this from happening. And how do they do that? They just make sure that when they're like allocating space on the stack, they allocate the extra byte to move this over one, rather than letting it be sort of misaligned like that. So let's do this case. So here, doing the same calculation, but in a different order. I'm computing my even sum by adding 0 and 2, and I'm computing my odd sum by adding 1 and 3. So, let's say, give you a little time, so how many misses do I expect with this, that same one block cache? So you can only store one thing at a time. And let's assume that the array starts at the beginning of a cache block. And also assume that I don't have to like even sum and odd sum are in register, so I don't have to worry about all that. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have two or fewer misses? Three misses. Four misses. Five or more misses. Okay, so I think the plurality answer is 4, but we definitely have a little bit of a spread. I get 4. And this is sort of, I'm just reasoning it out by figuring out what's in the cache at every time. So we access 0. We bring in 0 and 1. We access 2, we bring in 2 and 3. We access 1, well, we have to bring in 0 and 1. We can't bring in 1 and 2, that's not a cache block. Our cache blocks, remember, have to start in that sort of multiple of the block size. Even though we might want to bring in 1 and 2, you can't do it. Then we access 3, we have to bring in 2 and 3. So we have 4 misses, assuming we start empty. Just because we reorder things. And it kind of makes sense intuitively with locality because my original version, this has great spatial locality. And here, I damage the spatial locality a little bit. Now I'm skipping by 2 instead of 1. Okay, so questions? Okay, so this was kind of trivial because we have just one block in our cache. So let's move up to 2. So let's say I have a 2-set cache, same block size, but I have 2 sets now, so I have 2 rows in my cache. What's going to happen? How many misses are we going to have here? I'm back to the better spatial locality. Okay. Who would like some more time? You people? A little more. Okay, so who thinks we would have, let's start with two or fewer misses. Okay, three misses, four misses, five misses, six misses, seven or more misses. Okay, so plurality for four, that's the answer I get. And there's a couple ways we could figure this out. So one way you could figure this out is you could say, what are the blocks in our array? Well, given our array starts, we have array of 0 and 1, then we have array of 1 and 2, sorry, 2 and 3, because I can count, maybe, sometimes, then 4 and 5, and so on. And our access pattern is we're going to access 0 for the first time, so that has to be a miss. We haven't never read in 0 or 1, so it's not going to be in our cache. So we're going to have a miss there. And then we're going to access 1, which is the other part of the block we just accessed. So it better be in our cache, doesn't matter how it's organized, because we just read it in, it's gonna be there. Nothing could have happened to get rid of it. Hit, and then we access 2. First time, gonna be a miss, then a hit, so we can say it alternates between misses and hits that way. Another way we could reason about it is we could track the contents of each of our two sets in this cache, so the two rows, and I can say, okay, let's assume that the beginning of the array maps to index 0. If it maps to index 1, that's not a problem. I can just change all my zeros to ones and vice versa, and nothing changes as far as the results, just the label. So I can track it individually, but in this case, it doesn't. I don't actually need to go through that effort, but I can track this individually for each set. And something worth noting that makes this less tedious than it looks here, like here, it looks like each time I have to figure out what's in index 0 and what's in index 1. But I don't really need to do that, because what happens to set 0, the row 0 of the cache, doesn't affect row 1, and vice versa. So I can just look at the accesses that hit set 0, or that use set 0, which in this case is 0, 1, 4, and 5. I can look at them separately using the same method we had for our one set cache, our single row cache. Just act as if this is an independent cache, and do the same for everything that goes to set 1. So I can kind of just treat each set individually and add them together at the end to figure out how many misses there are in total. So that's another strategy you can use. So for this problem, not the simplest way, but we're going to get to something a little more complicated. Yes?
On the previous example, where does the tag and index come into play?
Where does the tag and index come into play?
Yeah.
So the index is what determines whether this 0 goes to set 0 or 1, and so on. The tag is how the cache is going to track that what I have stored here is array 2 and 3 and not array 6 and 7. Does that answer your question? Okay, so let's do this example. Yeah. What does two set means? That means it has two different rows. We're thinking about our direct map cache. So it has two rows in this sense. So remember, we took some index bits to determine which row to go to, so we have two of them. That's what two set means.
So
is it like a two-level page table for caches? No. It is like, the more analogous thing in page tables is that it is like a page table with two entries. But the analogy doesn't really work great, because they are kind of different. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we're gonna have four or fewer misses? Okay. Five misses? Six misses? Seven misses? Eight misses? Okay, so we have pretty good consensus for eight. And there are kind of, for this one, we kind of need to think about the sets a little more, because if we think about this access to one, we have a question of, you know, I should use the other color, this access to one here, well, we've accessed the other part of this block earlier. So the question is, why isn't that still gonna be in the cache? Because it could be, like if nothing else happened, that would be a miss for the zero, first time we're accessing that block, but then it hit for one. So the question is, does anything happening in between interfere? And one thing we can think about is that, well, we know that 0 and 1 and 4 and 5 are the same set. So those are the only things we need to worry about. So to think about what happens to 1, we just look for accesses to 4 or 5, and we see there's access to 4 in between. And that means that we're going to have a case where we store 0 and 1 in the cache, then we access 4 and store in that same row 4 and 5, then we access 1, so it's going to be a miss because we have that access to 4 in between. And to figure this out, I just said, okay, I know the accesses to 0, 1, and 4, and 5 all use the same set, and all the other accesses use different sets, different rows of the cache. I only need to think about row 0 for determining if the access to 1 is a miss. And we can repeat this process, and we'll end up finding out that all these accesses here are all misses, because we're going to have an intervening access before them that kind of replaces their row of the cache with the other block that could be stored there. So questions on how I figured that out? I'll just go to explanation. Yes?
So how does the mapping from like the cache lines to the actual memory decided? Is that like you always pick it like
So the question is, how is the mapping from cache lines to actual memory decided? So address 0 goes to set 0, then address, you know, block size goes to set 1, address 2 times block size goes to set 2, and so on until we run out of sets. Then we wrap around back to 0. And this works out the same as looking at the bits we call the index bits to determine where to go. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I was going to do these as exercises, but because I want to cover some things we want for the lab tomorrow, I'm going to just go through these quickly. So here, I've extended this example, and now I have a huge cache. It's 2 kilobytes, and I have 16 byte blocks. I want to know how many misses are there. And here, like with our first example, I don't actually need to think about the sets. I just think about, well, our blocks are going to be 0, 1, 2, 3, then 4, 5, 6, 7, then 8, 9, 10, and so on. And the first time I access something from this block has to be a miss because it was never in the cache before. So I'm going to have this pattern where as I go through my array here, it's going to be a miss, then some hits, then a miss, then some hits, and so on. So 1 out of 4 of these accesses are going to be misses. And why are 4 things in a block? Because they're 16 bytes. So how many misses am I going to have? I'm going to have 1,024 divided by 4, or 256. So questions on how I came up with that answer? Okay. So then we got to sort of our parallel version of this scenario. So what goes on here? So this is a lot harder because I can't use that trick anymore. So if I think about it, I have 0, 1, 2, 3, then 4, 5, 6, 7, and so on. And my question, probably the most interesting question is here, I'm gonna access when I equals 0, I'm gonna access array of 1. And I previously accessed, when I equals 0 here, array of 0, and when I equals 2 here, array of 2. And that means that I previously loaded the block containing 0, 1, and 2, and 3. But the question is it going to still be in the cache after I go through all the other i's? So to figure that out, we need to say, well, are any of those other i's going to map to the same set? And if we think about how this is going to work, if this is set 0, then we're going to have set 1, and so on. And we keep going until we run out of sets. So how many sets does our cache have? Well, we have 2048 divided by 16, which is going to be 128 sets. So I'm going to go up to set 127, rather, since I started with 0. And 127 times 4, so this is going to go up to 4 times 127, is going to be set 127, and then I'm going to go to set 0 again at 4 times 128, which is 1024 into the array. So when I have I equals 1024, that's going to replace 0, 1, 1, 2, 3 in that row of the cache, and we're going to end up having a miss again, just like in our miss when we access array of 1, because we have that intervening access. And this is going to end up mirroring our scenario here, where all those later accesses, the first time those first accesses to the blocks were misses, so we're going to have every other access is going to be a miss. Why every other? Because I'm going to access array of 1, that's going to be a miss. Then I'm going to access array of 3, that's at least going to be a hit. But that's all I'm going to get. Array of 3 is going to be a hit because I just accessed array of 1, running 0, 1, 2, 3. So questions on how I figured this out? Yes? Where do they get the 16? That's the size of each block, and there's one block per row.
Okay, but how does that differ from the last example where it was
4? How does it differ from the last example where it was 4? So here I'm figuring out this is the size of the cache divided by the size of the block. Here I'm figuring out the size of the array divided by 4 is this the number we have in the pattern. So if I was doing the same computation for the number of misses, so this is not the answer. The answer is that we're going to have 1024 divided by 2 equals 512 misses. So that's the actual answer. Same way, every other access is a miss. So 2 divided by 2. Does that clarify things? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've gone through sort of how to figure out cache accesses in arrays. And in practice, what do? We don't do that by hand. We can simulate it. So here, I ran something which would be really tedious to do by hand. I ran a binary search tree lookup at different sizes in a cache simulator, simulating a 16 kilobyte cache, and recorded the misses per instruction. And you can see that this is the cache size that kind of increases as it goes up, as the size of the binary search tree goes up. I did the same thing on my real cache on my desktop. And you can see we have this kind of pattern here. And I can also do this for other problems. So in practice, what we do is we know how to do that by hand. We can make software that does this simulation and use that to compute how many misses there are with different cache designs and different programs. But we're just doing the same process we did by hand of like figuring out what set does it go to, what's in the cache. Is that going to be the same as something earlier? We can have software do that for us. Yes?
So I have a question about one of the previous slides. I think it was like the 4 kilobyte example.
This one?
Yeah. So if a 4 kilobyte direct map cache, would that reduce the number of misses then?
So question, if this was 4 kilobytes instead of 2, would it reduce the number of misses? Absolutely. And that's because when we got to 4 times 1,028, that would still be, that wouldn't be set 0, that would be set 128. I'm going to keep going. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let me skip ahead to talking about peripheral. Yes. What are the strategies to reduce the cache misses? Generally, if you're writing code, the best thing you can do is improve your locality. If you're in the hardware, we're going to talk about one of the important ones for a particular kind of miss. So one thing you might have noticed here, might have noticed in some cases, is that something that can happen is that we can have some cases where we're unlucky and two things happen to go to the same row, the cache, and that causes problems. And here, I have a chart of cache misses for implementing a matrix multiply. And this matrix is stored as a 2D array, and sometimes, as we're going down a column of the array, when we go down the column, we're accessing things in the same set of the cache. Why? Just because they're a power of 2 bytes apart, and that's the same amount apart we go to get to end up at the same set. You saw in our example, when I went to 1,024 in the array, that mapped to the same set with that cache. So if we think of a matrix with 1,024 entries in a row, well, oops, we go down columns, we're going down the same set of the cache. And that's why we have this data point here. That is not an outlier. That is not a measurement error. That's real. And that's because things map to the same set. Yeah?
If we don't care about performance, couldn't we increase the size of cache to be really big?
If we don't care about performance, couldn't we increase the size of the cache to be really big? Yes. But if we don't care about performance, we don't need a cache. So how can we avoid this problem, avoid this type of problem? And this problem can also happen if we just happen to have two things that are just happen to be the right distance apart. Like, let's say I have these two arrays and they just happen to be exactly the right distance apart, so they map to the same sets of the cache. That would be really bad. This thing, which should be really nice performance for the cache, could be all misses. So how do we avoid that? And our solution is going to be to add what we call associativity to a cache. So here I have a cache, which is what we're going to call two-way set associative. And basically what I've done is rather than make my direct map cache bigger by adding more rows, I've kind of stapled two direct map caches together. And this means that now set 0, rather than having one block in it, it has 2 blocks. So we have 2 places to store values. And that means that rather than just saying, sorry, you just access 0, you just access 0, now 4 is not going to be in there, or something like that, we can say, oh, I have places for both of them. We access more than 2 things, well, we're still out of luck. But at least in this case, I have 2 places. So we're going to call each row here a set, and we're going to call each column a way. And the name here is two-way set associative. And we're going to split up our addresses similar to how we split them up for our direct map cache. So in this case, I have 2 byte blocks, so I have 1 offset bit. I have 2 rows, even though those rows contain 2 blocks, so I have 1 index bit. So I do my first access to address 0. I'm going to load that in. It's going to be a miss. Then I do an access to address 1. That's part of the block I just loaded. Great. I do an access to address 63. It's in index 1. So we look in this second row, set 1. We find out it's not there, and we add it. Then I access address 61, and it goes to index 0, and I check the tag of the first part, and it doesn't match. So I have to add it. I'm going to just use my second way to do that. Yes? I think there's something wrong with my mic. Interesting. Just clipping. Stored it? Okay, probably just too loud. Is this better, worse? Worse. This better? Nope. Okay. Wonderful. We'll do the. So, is this better? I should figure out which one is which. Yeah, this is the. This better? Nope. Yeah. Okay. Ish. No. It's a speaker? Oh, well, not going to be able to fix that. I guess we'll have to deal for 10 minutes. I can try lowering the volume a little bit to make it less obvious. Okay, so going back through our accesses here. So here, I accessed 6.1. It was index 0, so I checked both parts of this set, and I found it didn't match the place that was in, but rather than just replacing what was already there, I had an extra space. Great. So now, rather than having accesses to zero later on be a miss, this access to zero here, it's going to be a hit. So we have a hit here for the access to 6.2, then when we access zero, we didn't have to get rid of it. It's a hit. We got to take advantage of this relatively good temporal locality that we couldn't before just because two things happened to use the same set. And then we access 6.4, and we have a bit of a problem, which is that we're going to have to decide what to replace in here. And the short answer as to what are we going to replace is we're going to replace that ideally, we'd replace the least recently used block. Sometimes we can't implement that, but that's ideally what we'd replace. So what does this cache look like? Well, we're going to do our same cache lookup, but instead of just getting one block, we're going to get a bunch of blocks and their tags. We're going to check both all the tags and all the valid bits, and exactly one of them is going to match, or none of them are going to match. And if one of them matches, we return that one. If none of them match, it's a miss. So questions about this set associative lookup? Yeah?
What's the difference between this and just increasing the block size by 2?
What's the difference between this increasing the block size? And multiplying the block size by 2? So with this, we can store things from two different places. Whereas previously, we were running into the problem that when we had things from two different places that map to the same set, we can only store one of them at a time. And by not increasing the block size, though, we are not taking more advantage of spatial locality by doing this, but that's probably fine because our goal was to avoid these cases where just two things just accidentally went to the same set. And that's going to be a lot less bad with this type of design. Yes?
Question
is, when we're accessing a set, how do we know which one we want? We look at the tag. So the tag's going to tell us what address was originally stored there. So in this example, this address must be here because the tag matches the address we're looking at. Yes?
So basically, we have to check both tags every time we do this?
Yes. Question is, we have to check both tags every time we do this? Yes. And here I'm only showing two ways, but in practice we might have 4 or 8 or more. We'll have to check all the tags. So that's going to be a performance disadvantage, whereas with a direct map cache, we had one comparison to do. Here we have a lot of them, potentially. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yes, back there.
What is the mathematical relationship between the number of ways?
What's the relationship between number of ways and how the address is split up? So one way of thinking about it is that you could just figure out what this, the first way, looks like, and the cache is bigger by the number of ways, but the way we split up the address is the same as if we had a direct map cache of that size. Because we basically have, in this case, two direct map caches next to each other, and we're basically looking up in both and seeing which one matches. Does that answer your question? And if you want formulas, nope, that's not the slide. You want formulas, they're on this slide. But you can derive them by thinking about a direct map cache. So that's our direct map cache lookup. Yes, over there. Yes? No? Okay. Other questions? Did I miss? Okay. So our cache lookup, we take the index bits. We have the index bits. We figure out just how many rows are there. But in this case, rows have more than one block in them. We check the valid bits and the tags, and exactly, and either none of the valid bits, either we're not going to find any place which is valid and has the tag matching, or we're going to find exactly one. And we find exactly one, that's our hint. Questions about this process here? Yes?
Wouldn't it be faster if, like, if none of the blocks matches, there's like another, I guess, bit that can represent that so you don't waste time checking?
So the question, if none of the blocks matches, wouldn't it be faster to have like a separate bit? So is your concern that if none of the blocks are valid, wouldn't we like to have a separate valid bit? That is something we could do, but typically caches are going to have most of the blocks be valid because they're only invalid when we start up. So that's not probably not a worthwhile optimization for that reason. Other questions? Okay. So I mentioned earlier that we need to implement a policy to decide that when I want to insert something in this set here, I need to decide where to put it. Previously, I only had one choice, so it was easy. But here I have two choices. And I said the ideal policy is that we place it in the least recently used block. And why would we do that? Well, because of temporal locality. I want to choose the one that's least likely to be useful. And that's the one that we haven't accessed for a while. So in this case, I just accessed 0, so I probably want to keep that, but I accessed 6-1 longer ago. So 0 is the best bet on what to keep, and 6-1 is the best bet on what to throw away. But I can tell that here because I'm looking at this list of accesses here. How does the cache know? Well, for the cache to know, it's going to have to track that information. So for two ways, we'll have one bit tracking whether way 0 or way 1 is least recently used, and we have to update this on every single access, read or write. So all our reads have now become writes too. Maybe isn't so great. So this, as I said, this idea of tracking what's least recently used, this is kind of our ideal policy. And for a two-way cache, it's actually pretty good. Yes, we have to do these writes on reads, but it's a very small amount of data we have to write. It's very fast to do. We just like setting a bit to 1 or 0, and we can figure out whether it's 1 or 0 based on what we just accessed. It's great. But often, instead of having two ways, we'll have like 4 or 8 or 16. And least recently used doesn't really work very well for those. So we'll have other replacement policies. And the most common one in practice for caches with more than like two ways is going to be an approximation of least recently used. And why would we use an approximation? Well, one reason is that least recently used is a guess anyways, right? We're just assuming that the thing that's used least recently is least likely to be accessed soon. But that's not always true anyways, so why do we need to be precise about it? So instead, processors will use something where they'll track less information and avoid getting rid of replacing something that has been accessed recently, but not be picky about the order otherwise. But if we're implementing least recently used, we have to like track the exact order in which things were accessed, so we can do that at thing. And that's not really worth it. And some processor designers have said, well, that least recently used idea, we still have to update, even if we're approximating it, every time there's a read. That's annoying. So some caches have said, let's not do that. Let's just do first in, first out. Let's just keep a counter. We'll replace set way 0, then way 1, then way 2, then way 3, then way 0, then way 1, then way 2, then way 3. We'll just go in order. And some have said, that's too much tracking. Don't want to do that, and just chosen at random. And you might think, gosh, these other strategies must be really bad. they are. They turns out they do pretty well, weirdly. Just empirically, it's not so bad. And kind of the intuition for that is that if we make a wrong guess as what to replace, well, we're going to access it and bring it back and correct our mistake at not too much cost. Yes, some cost, but not too much. Okay, so before I finish up, I guess two things. So one, some terminology here. So I talked about set associative caches. There's one other special case that you'll sometimes hear, which is a fully associative cache. That just means a cache with so many ways, it only has one row. And one other thing for logistics. So we have a lab on doing things with set associative caches, sort of some kind of exercise-like problems that are randomized on Wednesday. On Thursday, I will not be here. Professor Skadron will be lecturing for me, and we'll be talking more about finishing up caches and talking about TLBs. So I'll see you next week, but you'll hopefully see Professor Skadron here on Thursday.